Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:44 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday and it is September 28th. So it's also the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And there's been a lot to talk about this week with the Federal Reserve raising interest rates. Then we've also had the breakout that we've seen in oil. Then precious metals weakened yesterday and then popped back, at least silver popped back on the upside in here today, and platinum also firmed, but it's still an unconfirmed situation for gold. Then we've also had the strengthening of the dollar at the same time, so that's another thing that it bears worthy of consideration. Then when we look at the stock market, it's been a week in which it's been reasonably quiet, but there does seem to be a rotation going on between the biotech sector and the semiconductor sector, and I'll show you a chart of that. But I thought that I would start off by looking at financial conditions, because the Bloomberg Index of Financial Conditions for the USA has been trending higher for the last for just about all of this year. Well, that's a rather odd situation, considering that the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates at approximately a quarter point every quarter, and they've been doing that now for 2 years. But and they've also been reducing the size of their balance sheet, and the increments by which they are going to reduce it is going to increase from the fourth quarter. So they are going to be removing approximately $50 billion worth of both agency and sovereign bonds from next month. So that's an acceleration of their policy. So that's so far not really had a big impact on the amount of liquidity that's available to the markets. So therefore, when we look at the performance of the stock market, it's perhaps not that surprising that we have this continued bull market, because the reality is that financial conditions remain relatively sanguine. The S&P 500 was down less than 2 points in here today. It remains in a consistent medium-term advance. Well, it also hasn't been able to hold rallies over the last three sessions, and there is a progression of higher reaction lows that's still intact. Really, that succession of higher reaction lows would really need to be broken in order to begin to signal that we're in a process of mean reversion, and there is a somewhat overbought condition relative to the trend mean, so that wouldn't be beyond the bounds of possibility. But perhaps the more important point is that the index is trading at new highs, and so far this breakout has been sustained. And as long as the breakout's sustained, then this remains a very clearly a bull market environment. The Dow Jones also joined it in new high territory at the end of last week. It gave up some of that advance in here this week, but it has been steadying in the last couple of days. And so far, I think that the most likely scenario is that the breakout will be sustained. Well, these are important considerations, not least because the dollar has been strengthening. And what I found particularly interesting last week is that there was a cacophony of commentary coming out suggesting that the dollar's rally was over, but it staged a pretty impressive rally in here today. In fact, for over the balance of this week, and that is demonstrating at least near-term support in the region of the trend mean. What I find particularly interesting is that the dollar has unwound approximately half of its decline that it posted in 2017 so far this year. And yet the pressure that has come to bear on a number of emerging markets has been out of character with the size of the dollar's rally versus the main currencies. The dollar has also broken out this week against the Japanese yen. So that, I think, is beginning now to suggest that we have been through a process of mean reversion for the dollar. In fact, it spent most of the year so far pausing against the yen, and it is now just breaking out. This continues to look like a dollar-dominant environment, and not least because the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. It is also raising interest rates. The US economy is still firing on all cylinders, and inflation has not yet picked up, so there is they really are in a sweet spot right now. Well, eventually, of course, that sweet spot will end, but there's no sign of it ending just yet. And because financial conditions are still loose and asset prices continue to increase, then that virtually ensures that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise interest rates, whereas it looks to be rather off in the distance when Japan is going to exit its quantitative easing program and begin to raise interest rates. Well, that has resulted in the stock market doing rather well. And the Nikkei had a downside key reversal yesterday and completely countermanded it in here today to push on to new high ground. This is still a really quite a bullish environment. There is a short-term overbought condition, and I'm rather leery of chasing any market higher in the current condition, but it does look like this is a new secular bull market for Japan. I've been to Japan now twice in the last 18 months, and there's nothing that I've seen has really gelled with what might be considered the received wisdom that people have tended to look on Japan with, that there has been a big increase in the number of women that are in the workforce. There are a lot of immigrants that are working in Japan, and that isn't something that many people, I think, really understand, not least because they can't tell the difference between someone who's Vietnamese or Korean versus someone who is Japanese, unless, of course, one is in fact Asian themselves. But the reality is that the Nikkei is doing something that it hasn't done in an awfully long time, and that is that it's trading at new 20-year highs. And this is a very different environment than we've seen for an awfully long time. The most important thing that it's done is that on every occasion it got up towards this 20,000 level, it made a new low, and that ended in 2016. And this now suggests that we are in a secular bull market for Japan. And it's being aided by the relative weakness of the yen. Well, what about the euro then? The euro has also weakened from this first area of potential resistance at the upper side of the range that's been evolving since June, and it was a little bit off the lows in here today, but it's an awfully big question why the euro should be strengthening from here. The ECB is faced with a rather difficult set of circumstances because inflation is starting to pick up in Germany and the German economy is still in rude health. But that is simply not the case on the periphery. So, is it going to tilt its monetary policy versus to the strongest participants or to the weakest? So far, it has been trying to tread a path between the two. But there is a simple reality, and it's that Italian debt is trading at what might effectively be considered double B standards. The yield now suggests that it really should be downgraded, but it's currently treble B, which is investment grade, and if it gets downgraded to double B, well, a lot of pension funds are not going to be able to hold it. And what that suggests is that when we look at the actual chart of the spread, or simply the absolute yield, well, this looks like a first step above the base. And I think that's a really important consideration, that yields had been going sideways for a prolonged period above around that 1% level, and then they've broken out. Well, so far that breakout has been sustained, and the move is it hasn't quite broken up out of this what I consider to be a first step above the base just yet, but it does look like that it is inevitable that that is going to happen. So when we think about what the outlook is for the fact that Italy is now going to run a wider deficit, and that the spread is starting to widen, and I've got the spread chart right here. If I can just drag this over, then we can see clearly that it isn't simply that We've had a breakout in the yield, but also that yields are moving up much faster than German yields, and German yields are moving higher. Well, this suggests that there is risk in Europe. There is certainly this crisis of confidence in the ability of the EU to hold together. And the contradiction that has been at the center of the Euro's entire project over the course of its history continues to be probed and explored. You simply can't have one fiscal or one monetary policy and 25 fiscal policies. And when a country like Italy, with that kind of debt and the size of its economy, decides that it is not going to follow the rules, well, what is it that the European Commission can do? Well, they have the ability to fine Italy approximately 0.2% of its GDP. But fining is one thing. That's only on the understanding that Italy will in fact pay the fine, and that's not at all something that we can or that they should be relying on. So this does represent a rather significant challenge for the Eurozone, and it's a further iteration of this inability of the bureaucracy to deal with the simple fact that the fiscal, I think, discipline that has been enforced on all members of the EU has fallen disproportionately on the most indebted. And you cannot simply rely or I think predict that people are going to tolerate lower standards of living indefinitely. Because if we look at what the outlook is for the rolling forward of Italy's debt and the paying down of that debt and running smaller deficits over long periods of time, it looks like that what was being demanded of the Italian population was that they could be facing another decade of lowering living standards, and that's a big ask. So the likelihood is that the Italian bond yield is going to be moving higher because there is a clear and present risk that it is going to be downgraded. Well, that is part of the reason why the MIB index has been pulling back from the region of the trend mean. It had rallied impressively to get up to it, but this was the first area of potential resistance, and resistance has been confirmed with an 800-point decline just in here today. But the much bigger picture is that the index has been ranging below 25,000 for a prolonged period. Well, one, I think, important point is when we think about Japan, well, Japan's bubble peak was in 1989. So it's really quite a long time ago. Whereas Europe has not really dealt with the problems that it has outstanding. And the ECB's anti-inflation mandate, in fact, and to combat inflation and to target inflation below 2% is their only mandate. Well, that constrains them from the kind of stimulus that is required to really get it going, get the economy going, because it would disproportionately favor the most indebted, and the moral hazard that's involved with that kind of stimulus is not something that Europe quite seems to have the stomach for just yet. So the Euro Stoxx index has been ranging below 400 now for a year and a half, and it has so far failed to sustain a move up and through the trend mean, and that trend mean is rolling over. This does not look like a bullish chart. So even though the euro has been weak, it has not translated into the kind of advance that we saw from euro devaluation back in 2015. That's a reflection of the kinds of challenges that Europe has. So while I think it's an easy conclusion that Japan is in a new secular bull market, then and also has a valuation discount to Wall Street, I would be very slow to reach that conclusion with regard to Europe, that there is also a valuation discount relative to the USA, but it's a deservedly low discount for the simple reason that there are big risks that the European project continues to probe. Well, when we look at what is going on as a result of the dollar's dominance, there is still pressure that is coming to bear on Argentina, and the peso broke down again in here today. Well, they lost their central banker this week, and they also secured a somewhat larger loan from the IMF than had initially been anticipated. But the market does not appear to have a great deal of confidence in the Macri's government, in Macri's ability to get inflation under control, and that's a significant issue. Then, when we look at what's going on in Brazil, well, we have the prospect of a firebrand populist leader winning the election, but the real has steadied again from this four level, and this doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation for the dollar in the region of its peak from back in 2015 and 2016. And that would suggest that we're going to see some additional upside. And that's particularly the case if the dollar continues to rally against the euro. Then, when we look at what is going on in China, well, China's currency has been stable in the region of the lows from back in 2016, but there doesn't seem to be any appetite for additional strengthening. And the more likely scenario is that if this trade war persists, then we're going to have a situation where the renminbi continues to deteriorate. Well, that is, I think, a medium-term consideration. Perhaps more important in the short term is that we are starting to see some evidence of demand coming back into the stock market. The A-share index has rallied over the balance of the last 2 weeks to break its progression of lower rally highs. Now, China is going to be off on Golden Week for all of next week, so quite whether it is going to be able to sustain this advance through the balance of the holiday will be very much open to question. We also saw a pretty impressive rally by the banking sector over the course of the last 2 weeks, and it has pushed back above the trend mean. So this is the most bullish action we've seen for the Chinese banking sector all year. And I think that is an important point, that what Xi Jinping is now starting to talk about is outright support for the private sector. I haven't heard anything saying that they're going to remove Communist Party offices from inside the every single private sector business with more than 50 employees, but they are starting to make positive sounds about supporting the private sector. So that should be generally positive for companies like Alibaba and Baidu. But so far, there hasn't been a great deal of a rally going on. Alibaba continues to hold this breakdown, and just by going sideways, it's gradually unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. Tencent, which is the major constituent of the emerging markets index, continues to remain weak. It was down again in here today. So far, rallies have been pretty modest, whereas the declines have been pretty sweeping, and it remains in a really quite consistent downtrend. And when we look at the emerging markets index, I'm just looking at the iShares ETF. Well, this succession of lower rally highs remains intact. So I think this is still an environment which is probing the downside for emerging markets. This has also been a very volatile week for the Indian banking sector, and it was just barely steady in here today. But the downside has been led by Yes Bank, which is one of the private sector banks, and that was in additional negative territory in here today, although it was off its low somewhat. Then Axis Bank has not been embroiled in the same kind of corporate scandal that a CEO being denied reinstatement by the central bank has, and Axis Bank has bounced from the region of those lows put in at the end of last week. So what this suggests is that yes, there is certainly some additional volatility in the Indian banking sector. The state-owned banks and even some of the private sector banks have not pulled back to the same extent. What that suggests is that the RBI is perhaps sending a signal to the lenders that they should really try and shape up their balance sheets voluntarily, or that the central bank is going to get much more aggressive. At the same time, the weakness of the rupee is acting as a tailwind for some of the what I guess are the companies that generate most of their income from overseas. So Tata Consultancy has been I think rallying in a very persistent manner. It's increasingly overextended relative to the trend mean, but little sign yet that the advance is over. And Reliance Industries' broadband market has continues to support additional upside. Now it's also catching some interest because of rotation out of the banking sector. But the banks are likely to throw up interesting investment opportunities over the medium term once this bad loans issue is dealt with more effectively. When we think about the long term, then India is, with its very young population and digital dividend, is likely to benefit over the long term, and not least if they can solve their bad loans problem in the banks, then that really will predicate a significant advance in the stock market over the medium term. But India also has this demographic dividend that China no longer has. China is now at a position where it is trying to encourage people to have more children and not having a great deal of success. And that's just not an issue in India, where half the population is under the age of 25. So despite the fact that India is subject to occasional bouts of volatility, and this is certainly one of those times, then every single time in the last, well, as long as I've been looking at markets, which at this point is about 18 years, I've never seen an occasion where India didn't wasn't subject to some volatility, and the weakness of the currency is certainly a headwind in the near term. But when it pulls back, it's almost always been a very favorable entry opportunity from the perspective of a longer term investor. So, for example, the JP Morgan India Trust has pulled back rather violently over the last 5 weeks. It's being led lower by the banks and by the currency, and it's at a new low. We can go back and look at its history over the course of the last say 15 years, and we can see that there have been a number of occasions when it has pulled back violently, and each one of those has been a buying opportunity. But it does not yet suggest that this decline is over, and that there is we know what that would look like. We would see a very clear upward dynamic. We've seen those kinds of moves at just about all the previous lows, and so far, there has been an absence of that. In fact, what this chart looks like is a type 2 top with right-hand extension. We have the loss of momentum, the failed upside breaks, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, the rally back up to the trend mean, and the failure. So this is about as textbook an example of a type 2 top as we might hope to or well, hope. Obviously, nobody hopes for a type 2 top in something that they own, but it is a very clear textbook example of a top. When we then think about what it is that we can anticipate from the long term, that emerging markets are going to continue to be volatile. And that is part of the reason why people want to be invested there. What we've also seen is that the evolution of ETFs and of index investing means that when people buy emerging markets, what they end up owning are the largest cap shares. And MSCI is changing its weightings and it's going to be starting to give more, even more influence to mainland Chinese shares. They're going to represent a much larger weighting within the emerging markets index at the expense of weightings for South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and India. Well, what that really means then is that rather than buying an emerging markets ETF, then one really does need to look at the individual countries on their own merits. And right now, Thailand is leading by virtue of the fact that it's been much less volatile, and it has bounced from the region of the trend mean. The currency is not accelerating lower. In fact, it's doing rather better. This is the inverse here with the dollar falling against the Thai baht. So this does suggest that when we look at the outlook for the emerging markets, that it is a very different story looking at those that represent the big weightings in ETFs, where big funds are moving in and out of what they consider to be emerging market baskets, and then the relative performance of individual countries. Indonesia, for example, raised rates in here this week, and that has at least arrested the decline. But so far, this remains a consistent trend higher for the dollar. It has merely paused over the course of September, and really a very clear downward dynamic would be required to suggest that we're back in a rupiah-dominated environment. When we look at markets like Taiwan, the Taiwanese dollar has not been immune from devaluation, but I think what's rather interesting is that the index has broken up and away from this 10,000 level. But what I am concerned with in the short term is that we've had this loss of momentum, and of course, Taiwan is the world center for semiconductor production, and the range over the last year coincides rather closely to the range that has developed in the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index. Well, semiconductors did fantastically well in 2016 and 2017, and now they have lost momentum. Well, biotech did fantastically well between about 2011 and 2015. And when we look at that on the longer term chart, that rally that we saw, and I think we really should look at it on a much longer term horizon, just to give us a clear indication of just how long the base in biotechnology was, that the breakout by Biogen back in 2010 was a lead indicator for the breakout that we subsequently saw in the phenomenal bull market that hit a medium-term peak in 2000. Well, biotech has been underperforming semiconductors for the last few years, but it is now exhibiting relative strength. It has pushed on this week to test the upper side of its range. And an increasingly large number of companies in the biotechnology sector have been turning to outperformance. So, when we look at the spread between the two, rather than the spread, the ratio between the two, we're presented with a rather interesting chart that you had the very clear outperformance of biotech all the way through to the peak in 2015, and then a very clear underperformance over the course of the last year, and it has just broken out. So on a relative basis, it suggests that biotech now has got a better potential to outperform semiconductors. And that's a very large rotation, considering the extent to which we've seen acceleration occur in the semiconductor sector. The Advanced Micro Devices has been going from strength to strength, and it has rallied rather spectacularly over the course of the last few months, but it really does look susceptible to additional downside in here. Nvidia was the best performing share on the S&P 500 in 2016 and 2017, and it continues to do well, and it was up again in here today. So it may be what we might consider an outlier within the sector. But for example, Intel has had a more difficult time, and it has pulled back rather sharply over the last few weeks. Now, of course, just because you get relative performance doesn't necessarily mean that the semiconductors index is going to collapse, but it does suggest that biotech has got room to outperform, and not least because it's coming off of such a low base. So I'm going to, in comment of the day today, I'm going to post a lot of biotechnology shares. But I thought that I would share some of them with you right now. So, for example, BioMarin has got first step above the base characteristics. Then, if we look at, for example, the Endo International, and not all of these are large cap shares, but Endo International has also got this firming characteristic that it has bounced very clearly after what was an incredible decline. Then, when we look at, for example, Atara Biotherapeutics, well, Atara has also got first step above the base characteristics. Then, if we do look at some of the larger cap shares, well, Amgen has broken up and away from what was really quite a lengthy range. Then, Gilead has been ranging now for much of the last year, but it is firming from the region of the trend mean. And Biogen had the announcement that it's been making progress on Alzheimer's approximately 3 or 4 months ago, and it has held all of that advance, and it's starting to firm within its range again. So if I click through my lists of biotechnology shares, there are obviously those that have done spectacularly well recently and are now overextended relative to the trend mean. But the number that are accelerating lower is far outweighed by those that are firming from the region of their trend means or breaking out of bases. And I haven't seen this kind of commonality in the biotechnology sector since 2010. So I do think that this is a very important change that we're seeing in the markets. But what it also there's two additional points that I think bear consideration from a longer term perspective. The first is that biotechnology represents a cyclical area of the market. So cyclical shares generally tend to do best when we're in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market. Therefore, it's the time when interest rates are rising, but they do not represent much of a headwind just yet, and global growth is doing well, and there's plenty of money around. Well, that's certainly the case for cyclical businesses like healthcare and biotech. There is the additional point that we're in a golden age of technological innovation, and the healthcare sector is one of the primary beneficiaries of that. We have, on the one hand, there is genetic sequencing, and Illumina continues to represent the leader in terms of the machines for genetic sequencing and continues to push on. But the cost of genetic sequencing continues to trend lower. Then you have CRISPR gene editing technology, which greatly enhances the speed with which innovation can happen. Then you have artificial intelligence and deep learning, so that computers can now iterate through many more potential solutions to a problem than was previously possible, and it's multiples of the speed with which innovation can occur. Well, then you also have the regulatory environment, not least since the Trump administration took power. And these are all coalescing to create a bull market environment. But this, considering that we had the massive breakout from the base in biotech that really ended in 2015. If this were not a secular bull market, then it would have given up the entire advance. The fact that it bottomed less than a year later and has been recouping the loss and moving higher in a jerky but a reasonably rhythmic manner is a testament to just how big a story this is. Because we are on the cusp of truly personalized medicine. And when we consider the fact that energy is a massive drain on the financial resources of everybody on Earth, well, so is cancer, so are cardiac events, and these are the kinds of solutions that we're getting increasingly close to solving. Well, we can also start to think about the potential for designer babies, our designer solutions. There are umpteen ethical issues with what is going to be possible, but I think there is also the consideration that not every country has got the same way of thinking about ethical issues, and the innovation is going to happen one way or another. So that's one point. When we think about the outlook for technology generally, well, we saw this week that Italy had an auction for a 5G network, that 5G is being rolled out in the US right now. Well, 5G is what is a fundamental or an enabling technology for the telecommunications sector, for the simple reason that it is the required piece of technology that's going to enable autonomous vehicles. It's the next iteration of the online world. Then, if you remember back in, it was probably 2012 or 2013 that General Electric was making a big talk about its innovations in the Internet of Things. Well, the Internet of Things is impossible without a lot more bandwidth, and that is what 5G is going to deliver. When we think about the potential for the connected home, the potential for for machines to perform self-diagnostic operations, these are all going to be part and parcel of the Internet of Things, and it simply can't happen until we have more bandwidth. So therefore, it's the evolution of 5G that really truly represents the gateway to the Internet of Things and autonomous vehicles. Well, Cisco Systems has been performing admirably over the course of the last couple of years and completed its base in 2016. But part of the reason that it did so spectacularly well back in the 1990s is because it was supplying the infrastructure that built the internet. And 5G is an additional infrastructure spend. It doesn't need the laying of wires, so that isn't likely to represent the same kind or expense of an inventory build as was required in the 1990s, but it is another infrastructure build, and Cisco and companies like it are tending to do better as a result. Juniper Networks would be another example that has not quite yet broken up and out of its base formation, but it does look increasingly likely that that will in fact be the case. Well, technology is not just in the medical sector or in the telecommunications sector. It's also in the manufacturing sector. So when we look at, for example, 3D printers, well, they had a phenomenal bull market back in 2013, and then they collapsed. Well, we had massive consolidation within the sector. But right now, today, 3D printers represent about 1% of manufacturing. And within the next decade, it'll probably represent approximately 10% of manufacturing. There are issues that need to be overcome with regard to the quality of iterative manufacturing. So that is a challenge for the sector, but these represent base formations. That we see a base formation certainly in 3D systems, and when we look at stratices, and I think that's the correct ticker, yep. Stratices also had the big advance, also had the big decline, and also has this base formation. Well, it's inevitable that with the rise of populism and trade wars, that automation and the outlook for reshoring and localization of the manufacturing process is going to become more of a topical conversation. Well, then you also have the relative advantage that the USA now has as being one of the, well, it is now the largest oil producer in the world and increasingly moving towards exports. So that removes rather than removing a headwind, it creates an incentive to locate highly energy intensive industries within the USA, not least because it is also the end market for a number of those industries. When we think about the fact that there are huge numbers of people that are involved in manual labor and manufacturing in the emerging markets, they are increasingly going to have to compete with robotics and compete on the fact that you have an energy advantage and a logistics advantage by reshoring. And when you remove the incentive that there were no trade barriers, then that represents a significant challenge. One of the biggest impediments to a continent like Africa being able to reach the critical mass necessary to evolve economically is the creation of a manufacturing sector to follow the kind of evolution in terms of economic potential that Asia and indeed Latin America followed. Well, that also means that Africa has to be in an enormous hurry to improve its standards of governance, or it is going to miss out on the potential to really evolve economically. Well, we're already seeing that countries are getting their act together, not least Ethiopia and Ghana. Nigeria currently has a large population, and it is rife with corruption, but perhaps not quite as rife with corruption as it was previously. And I think more than anything else, that really does ram home the point that governance is not an absolute. It's about the trajectory of governance that is more important. That's why China has had such a difficult time this year, because the trajectory of governance is deteriorating. The Indian market, in fact, it might be going through some issues right now, but tackling an issue with bad loans is a sign of good governance. And the standards of governance in Africa may be quite low, but they do appear to be improving. Well, if we go back and think about cyclical sectors, well, the kinds of cyclical sectors that are currently doing well are certainly the biotech sector, but so is energy. And oil prices broke up and out of their range on Brent crude did anyway this week. Well, so far this year, we've had two $10 consolidations. Each one of those consolidations resulted in a reversion to the mean. And when you had the reversion to the mean, the subsequent rally was approximately $80. Well, the trend mean was most recently tested around 70. So the next area of potential resistance is around 90. And if this is going to remain a consistent trend, well, we could anticipate then a $10 pullback to $80. And that's, of course, on the assumption that it remains a consistent trend. But one of the interesting things about consistent trends is that the more widely known the consistency of the trend is, the less likely it is to be repeated. And there is the possibility that now that prices are pushing through $80, that they could accelerate. Well, an acceleration in oil prices does tend to represent a headwind to economic growth. But it's most particularly a headwind to the consumers of oil. And, well, China, India, and Japan, and of course Europe, are the major consumers of oil. Obviously, when we look at Russia right now, it is benefiting enormously from the higher oil price, and it has bounced pretty emphatically over the course of the last couple of weeks. Well, oil prices are a headwind to economic growth, but they're also a reflection of the more difficult geopolitical environment that we have right now, because the supply of oil from the USA has benefited enormously from technological innovation with hydraulic fracturing, better geophysics, and horizontal drilling. Whereas supply has collapsed from Venezuela, it's collapsing in Iran as a result of sanctions. Libya has struggled to get its production back on track, and Mexico is another good example where the country was pumping in the region of 3.4 million barrels a day back in 2005, and right now it's about 1.8, and it continues to trend lower. Well, Mexico has got much of the same geology that they do in Texas, and that is also a further demonstration of the impact of governance. So we have to, I think, bear some mind to the fact that populism is rising, and the pockets that we have of good governance are decreasing. And I really don't think that this is a random set of events. The reality is that bond yields have been coming down since 1980, and then we had the era of quantitative easing. Well, quantitative easing resulted in a sharp appreciation in asset prices, and most particularly bond prices. And now yields are back around the 3%, and that represents the upper side of this, what is effectively 7-year base formation on treasury yields. Well, a lot of the play along to get along environment that we've had in primarily in the West, or certainly within the OECD, has been predicated on increasing debt levels. That technological innovation is inherently deflationary, but the reality is that the countries that have most aggressively adopted technological innovation still have their manufacturing sectors. Whereas it has been in the countries that have not really invested heavily in adopting new technological innovations where manufacturing has withered and died. At the same time, the accession of China to the WTO, which was one of the last pieces of paper that Bill Clinton signed in his presidency, has opened the door to a massive migration of resources and jobs from Europe and North America to China, and on not particularly good terms either. Well, the reality is that that has denuded huge areas of the previous industrial heartland, and those jobs have never really been replaced. And what has happened is that social benefits have increased to try and take their place, but that's all been predicated on debt. And that is possible as long as yields continue to fall. In a disinflationary environment, you can continue to increase your debt load because it's progressively cheaper to refinance. But when that eventually ends, and it's worth considering that period of disinflation and mounting debt has been in evidence now for 40 years, which very much coincides with a Kondratiev wave. Well, then we have to at least pay some due consideration to the potential that it's not going to persist. The fact that quantitative easing failed in leveling the playing field between savers and traders, and in fact robbed savers at the expense of to favor the trading community, has resulted in this rise in populism. Well, this widening gap between the rich and poor is not something that is going to persist indefinitely within democracies. So we've seen this rise in populism, but I think it is also worth considering that we've seen this rise in populism in an environment where economies have been doing better, where employment has been trending higher for a decade, and generally speaking, it's been a bull market environment. What that suggests is that the next time we have a recession, the upsurge in populism is going to be much larger than we have right now, and most particularly if borrowing costs increase. So I really think that the rise of populism is a very clear correlation with the fact that bond yields are starting to turn, that the condition on which the status quo has been predicated over the last 40 years has been on an increasing debt load. And we may well be coming towards the end of that process. It's not over yet, but we are getting to a point where there is going to have to be some reckoning in terms of the quantity of debt that's outstanding. So Iceland pursued one way of thinking about it, and they wrote down the debts of people that had foreign currency debts. So that was one way of doing it, that the debt can disappear. But that represents a significant challenge for a much larger economy, and most particularly when most of your debt is held externally. So that does represent a significant challenge, and not least because of unfunded liabilities. So there is going to be a reckoning at some stage. But I think the more important consideration in the short to medium term is that we do not yet have lead indicators for future recessions that are really flashing red. The yield curve spread is certainly trending lower, but it has paused over the last month. And it was at 19 basis points last month. It's at 24 right now, but eventually it will become inverted. And even when it does become inverted, then we probably have a lead indicator for the next recession for anything from 6 months to 18 months from the date of the inversion. Unemployment continues to trend lower. And as long as unemployment is trending down instead of up, well, it's hard to imagine that you can have a recession without unemployment rising. But it's perhaps not a necessary condition, but it's certainly continuing to trend lower, which suggests that we're still in a bullish environment. Well, it looks like Elon Musk's time as CEO of Tesla may be numbered, but high yield bond spreads are still very much contained. That's particularly the case in the USA. We've already seen that high yield spreads are rising in Asia and rising in Europe, but they are still well contained in the USA. Well, when we start putting all of these things together, then it really does suggest that we are not at a point where we're going to have a recession. And that is obviously out there at some point on the horizon, but it is not right now. Well, I think we do need to think about what is the outlook for precious metals. The gold price pulled back in here this week and bounced in here today, but it has got a distinct absence of upward dynamics within this range. The last upward dynamic that we saw was towards the end of August, and it has been struggling to improve upon that performance. So it is still very much open to question just whether gold can sustain a rally. The most encouraging thing that we have right now is that silver did rebound emphatically in here today, and it was up almost 40 cents. And it's pushing back up into that overhead trading range, and it triggered a midpoint danger line stop in here today. Platinum has also triggered a midpoint danger line stop. It's back above the $800 area. And what this at least is beginning to suggest is that the bottoming process has begun for the precious metals. Well, precious metals don't do especially well when the dollar is surging and when the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. When precious metals do best is when inflation is rising faster than central banks are willing to raise interest rates, and we have rather the opposite condition right now. But the other point, of course, is that stock markets continue to do reasonably well, and we still have, or I think the jury is still out on whether bond yields are going to sustain the move up and away from their current range. I tend to think that it is inevitable that bond yields are going to break out at some point in the next year, and potentially within the next month, not least because the Federal Reserve is going to be selling even more of them. But that and that's on top of the additional issuance that the Treasury has planned. Well, the chances, therefore, then, that gold can start to benefit from a safe haven asset play, not least because it is so cheap now relative to its potential, I think has to be given the potential, or at least we have to consider that that's a possibility, not least considering that it has been falling just about all year. So I think that when we start to think about cheap assets, gold and gold shares are certainly well represented. If China is in fact starting to support its economy, then the industrial metals should start to do better. And they are also highly cyclical. So if we have oil and mining and biotech performing or returning to a position of outperformance, that does represent the and most particularly if they improve upon their recent performance, that does represent the return to performance of cyclical sectors in the latter stages of a bull market. And we also need to keep an eye on the banking sector, and most particularly within the USA, because it pulled back rather sharply in here this week with the rising interest rates. But the US banks have been the ones that have been recapitalized first and most effectively. They've also represented relative strength. European banks continue to trend lower and were down rather heavily in here this week. The Chinese banks have been trending lower all year, and they really do need to hold the rally they've put in over the last 2 weeks. And the Topics Banks Index has been ranging now for 18 months, but it pushed back above the trend mean last week, and now the question is whether it is going to hold that. I rather think that it's a better bet that Japan is going to eventually allow JGB yields to appreciate. When we look at the outlook for the 10-year yield in Japan, it has first step above the base characteristics. Well, obviously, this is a highly manipulated market and very closely managed by the Bank of Japan, but nonetheless, this looks like a first step above the base. We also have a first step above the base in Italy, and when we look at the outlook for the German Bund, well, this is a reasonably well-defined range. So I think we're not quite yet at the end of the bull market in bonds, but Treasuries are the one to keep the closest eye on, for the simple reason that the US is leading in this cycle. It's also where we have the greatest evidence of the potential for a base to be completed. And within the US bond markets, it's the TIPS yield I think I tend to look at most often, for the simple reason that there is no additional supply of TIPS anticipated. And yet we still have this five-year base formation that it does look increasingly likely that it is going to be resolved on the upside. Well, when TIPS yields take out the 1% level, then we can conclude in no uncertain terms that we're back in a supply-dominated environment. Then you also have the 30-year, which has been ranging below 3.25% for the last 4 years, and it is within 5 basis points of breaking out. So I think when we think about where the risks are definitely in the debt markets, because one of the hallmarks of every major bull market is that in the latter stages of secular bull markets, supply explodes. And that's exactly what we've had in the bond markets. We just do not have that in the equity markets right now. In fact, with the quantity of share buybacks, it's superseding the quantity of new IPOs. And that's, I think, a relatively global phenomenon. So the risks are in the bond markets, the pace of technological innovation, and the rise of the global consumer, particularly in the world's young population centers, represent clear secular bull market arguments for the equity sector. And in the meantime, there is the potential that this medium-term advance that we've had over the course of the last decade could climax in acceleration, because something that probably needs some consideration is that there's approximately $500 billion, it could be even more than that, being managed by risk parity strategies. If bond yields do in fact start to rise, then the way to lay off that risk would be to increase the equity portion of a portfolio, and that is the kind of demand that could help to drive an additional advance in the stock market. So we, I think, have to be alert to the possibility that we could have an accelerated climax to this medium-term bull market before we have the next recession, which will create the most attractive buying opportunity in a decade before this secular bull market eventually climaxes in the mid or early 2030s. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.